gets our hearts prepared for the Word. Well, we are back in our list in Hebrews 11:32, and if you thought it was hard to find some faith in Samson, we've just upped the ante this week because it's even more difficult to find some faith in our judge this week, who is Jephthah. Hey, what more shall I say? For time will fail me if I tell of Gideon, Barak, Samson. Next up in our list is Jephthah. I like to say we like to look at things. It's easier if we can look at things in black and white. If we can look at things as absolutes. Now we know there's absolute truth. We understand that, but with people we're not always so lucky. So I'll date some of you with this movie. But I actually read the book, so let me challenge you for that. So, anybody remember this movie? I'm going to date some of the older folks in the room. This is Shane. Remember Shane? Well, how do we know that Shane, just by looking at him, why do we know that Shane is the good guy? He's got a white hat. That was the way it was in the Westerns, right? White hat, good guy. Black hat, bad guy. And, of course, in the Shane movie, Jack Palance plays Jack Wilson, who's the bad guy. Right, because he wears a black hat, and there's not many better bad guys than Jack Palance, but he works really well for that. But then I wanted to get into my childhood, and I was thinking about the absolutes of good and evil, and the place where good and evil played it out for me as a kid was in the professional wrestling ring, and you knew who the good guys and the bad guys were. So when you saw these guys. We knew, I'm supposed to boo those guys because this is the 1980s and Russia is evil, right? Never mind that Ivan on the right is from Ontario and Nikita on the left is from Minnesota. But I didn't know that at the time. They were the Russians and they used chains and they've cheated and they were always up to no good. And so I knew to boo those guys. It was absolute. And then on the other side, you had, Hulk Hogan. He's the good guy. USA, USA. You cheered that. You knew that. It was just the absolutes were on display. And then I move into, later life with literature and whatnot. And I read something like Lord of the Rings, and it's very clear who the good guys were and who the bad guys were. The elves and the men and the hobbits against orcs and dark lords. It wasn't really difficult to decide which side was good and which side was bad. But in the midst of that story, I think is a character that embodies our judge today, and that's Gollum. Is that Gollum is this, on first glance, very evil creature, very misguided in what he's pursuing, and yet there are times when you look at him and you go, well, that was pretty good. And there's a scene early in the movie where Gandalf comments on Gollum, and he says, I think he's still got a part to play in this. For good or worse, he's still got a part to play in this story. He's a part of God's plan for this as well. And so that could have been the title, Jephthah is Gollum. But from the judge's narrative alone, it's really hard to find why we find Jephthah in Hebrews 11. Because that's the question. How did he get into this hall of faith? Based on what we read in Judges 11 and or 10, 11, and 12, well, how in the world did he get in there? That there's not much in there that jumps out at us. Even Samson had that moment at the end of his life where he calls out to God and he trusts God and great things happen. We don't necessarily have that as overtly in Jephthah's story. So I got a lot of stuff to go through tonight. I'll try not to go too fast, but I've got to set up the background before we get to the part of the story that we really want to look at tonight, which is the Jephthah and his vow with his daughter. But this is the Jephthah cycle, if you want to talk about what happens in these chapters. And I want to go through the first two pretty quickly and give you an overview of what's going on. But Jephthah's always adversarial against somebody. And in two of these cases, he's adversarial against his own people. And Gilead and Ephraim, those are Israelites that he's fighting against. Now, he's going to start here with Gilead, and it's going to be a negotiation process because of what's going on in Gilead, and I'll talk about that. Then he's going to go to Ammon, the Ammonites, who are the enemy, and he's going to do some diplomacy with them. And then we're going to have the episode with his daughter. We won't cover the chapter 12 part tonight, but even after the foolish vow with his daughter, he ends up killing 42,000 Israelites when Ephraim is bent out of shape for not getting called into the battle. Ephraim's a whole other set of troublemakers, but that's a story for another day. And so we won't get into that. So let me go through this. In Judges 10, 17 and 18, This is what we see. Then the children of Ammon were gathered together and encamped in Gilead. And the children of Israel assembled themselves together and encamped in Mizpah. And the people and princes of Gilead said one to another, "What man is he that will begin to fight against the children of Ammon? He shall be head over all the inhabitants of Gilead." Why do I mention that? Well, number one, it tells us where what the conflict is. When this cycle starts, it's the Ammonites that are the problem. Here's your map. Remember, we talked about the Philistines with Samson came from the coast. This is all the way on the other side of the Jordan. And the Ammonites are actually invading territory here that's Israel's. That's the tribal allotment of Gad and Reuben. And they're coming from the south, and they're invading those lands. So this all happens on the other side of the Jordan. This is a trans-Jordan conflict, okay? And so they say, who are we going to get to lead us? And notice in verse 18, they say, "He shall be head over all the inhabitants of Gilead." We'll make him our head. The Hebrew there is rosh. It means first. He'll be our leader. He'll be our, almost saying he'll be our king, all right? And now when we get to Judges chapter 11, we meet our judge. Now, and notice the weird linkage here. Now, Jephthah the Gileadite was a valiant warrior, but he was the son of a harlot. Those two things don't often go together. Those seem like weird combinations there, but the valiant warrior, son of a harlot, and Gilead was the father of Jephthah. Gilead's wife bore him sons, and when his wife's sons grew up, they drove Jephthah out and said to him, "You shall not have an inheritance in our father's house, for you are the son of another woman." So Jephthah fled from his brothers and lived in the land of Tob, and worthless fellows gathered themselves about Jephthah, and they went out with him. All right, so what is going on here? Well, number one, I can show you what this is. The little Monopoly house is where he lived. That's where he was born. And when his brothers kicked him out of the house, he went and lived way over here in the land of Tob. Now, Tob means good. So it must have been a decent neighborhood. Not so much based on the people that come to see him, but it's like when you, if you've ever heard a Jewish person say mazel tov, that tov is tov, it means good. So that means good luck. So tov is the land of, the good land is where he moves to. But it seems like there are a lot of brigands and bandits and questionable folks out there because it says that worthless men surround him. Now his name means he has opened. The name probably reflects the gratitude of Jephthah's mother for having born a son. The question is, when it says he has opened, it's not Yahweh has opened, it's not El has opened, it's he has opened. So the question is, which deity is being credited with his birth? It could be any number of deities when we're talking about a he idea there. And with the mother's profession, when I say profession, that's a nice way to say her job, she's a harlot, right? The father's actions, the character of his half-brothers, his own lifestyle, all point to a thoroughly Canaanized environment. It doesn't seem that they're worshiping Yahweh very well in his neighborhood or where he goes to. And so there's a lot of questions. And, you know, the main question with the aspect of his birth is, what is his father doing visiting a harlot? And then you want to back that up and go, okay, well, let me ask some questions about the harlot herself. Is she a Canaanite? Well, if she's Canaanite, then we're speaking to Jephthah's father going and entering into a relationship with someone outside of Israel. That's a problem based on the law. What if she's Israelite? Well, that means we've got prostitutes within the land acting that way. That might be even worse. And then if she's a cult prostitute, if she's at a temple, then we've got idol worship and paganism going on within the land. Whatever happened here, it's not a good situation, and it speaks to the fact that Yahweh worship has kind of gone to the wayside where we are. Now, what do we know about Jephthah? Well, he's expelled from his family. He's a resourceful warrior. He's bold. He's not timid. He flees to the land of Tob. He lives life as a brigand and a bandit. He has a band. He has a gang that goes with him. Worthless fellows. And he leads raiding parties into villages. So if you want a picture of who he was in ancient Israel, he's Robin Hood. Okay. He's got a group of men with him, and they lead raiding parties on villages, but he doesn't have nearly the good intentions that Robin Hood does. He's a rejected son of a harlot. He's a man without a physical home, a social home, or a future. That's our hero that's going to come and deliver Israel. That's who we're depending on. Okay? So here's the interesting part about all this. If you read the book of Judges and read through the whole thing, Jephthah uses the name of Yahweh more frequently than any other person in Judges. This guy, his life does not seem to reflect that faith, and yet he uses the covenant name of God more than any other. And as careful as Israelites are with the use of that divine name, maybe there's an indication of his faith there. He knows Yahweh. He doesn't refer to him as Elohim, as God in a generic sense. He refers to him by his specific name. And so his faith may be evident in what he says, but it isn't very evident in what he does. Right? I'm trying to find the faith in the story. When he trusted God, just like Gideon and Samson, great victories were achieved. But God uses imperfect vessels. We can come down to that, and Jephthah is quite the imperfect one. So let me give you an overview of chapter 11. And what we figure out is that Jephthah is a master negotiator. He is a diplomat. He knows how to talk. He knows how to work his way through situations. And so when we get to 11:4, the Ammonites are there. Gilead comes to Jephthah in 11:5 and 6, and they say, if you will defeat the Ammonites for us, we'll make you the general of our army. Well, that's not what they said in chapter 10. Remember, I mentioned that verse earlier. They said, we're going to make him our king. And I think the word got out, and Jephthah basically calls their bluff and says, I don't know about that deal, but if you'll make me your king, I'll go ahead and do this for you. And so that he negotiates with them, and eventually he wins that argument. And they go, okay, if you'll get rid of the Ammonites for us, we'll make you our king, our leader. Well, that also shows you that Jephthah has a reputation for winning some battles, because he must be a warrior if that's the case. And that's the sarcastic idea. Then Jephthah seizes that opportunity. Then he goes and negotiates with Ammon. And this is, well, by the way, let me back up to verse 11:7. When they say, we need your help, he says, did you not hate me and drive me from my father's house? So why have you come to me now when you were in trouble? You know, he's basically like, I got all the cards here. Why should I help you? What are you going to give me to make this? Well, what are we learning about Jephthah? It's about him. He's very selfish in all this. Now, the Lord will use him to deliver Israel from the Ammonites, but it's not because he wants to do God's work. He wants to do things for himself. Then he negotiates with Ammon for the rest of the chapter, and he goes to the Ammonite king, and this is a really interesting conversation, and I think it's interesting because of so many 21st century parallels, 20th and 21st century parallels to it. He goes to the king of Ammon, and he says, why are you in our land? Why are you trying to invade? And the Ammonite king says, because you stole this land from us. And he says, actually, check your history. And he tells him the story of the Exodus, and he says, we actually came up here, and we were down at Kadesh, which is not here, and then we wanted to come through Edom, but Edom wouldn't let us come through, so we came around the other side, and then we asked King Sihon if we could come through his land, and he was an Amorite, not an Ammonite, and then he sent his soldiers against us. We defeated him fair and square, and we took the land. So historically, we didn't steal this land, and historically, you weren't even here. You didn't come around until later. So do you see the Israel-Palestine conversation here? You were never here, so your historical argument doesn't make any sense. Then Jephthah says, from a theological perspective, he says, hey, don't you have gods? Because we have a God, and our God, Yahweh, gave us this land. If your God was so powerful, he would have given you this land instead of us, but our God won, so we should have this land. Then he says, practically, if it was such a big deal, if this goes all the way back to the Exodus, then why are you just now bringing this up? Where were you 300 years ago? Where were you 400 years ago? Now it's a problem? And he just pokes a bunch of holes in. Of course, the Ammonites kind of just throw their hands up and say, all right, we're going to fight. And war is going to happen because of that. So verse 29 says, now the Spirit of the Lord came upon Jephthah, just like it did with Gideon, just like it did with Samson. So they passed through Gilead and Manasseh. Then he passed through Mizpah of Gilead, and from Mizpah of Gilead, he went on to the sons of Ammon. So the Lord is active again. He empowers Jephthah for his agenda. Here's the thing. We don't even know if Jephthah is aware that he's empowered by the Lord. Gideon knows because he has that conversation with the angel. Have you noticed who hasn't been in this story yet? God is nowhere to be found. You know, he raises up Jephthah, but he doesn't send an angel to send a word. He doesn't speak to Jephthah. We don't even know if he realizes it, but it allows him to build an army and lead them into battle. And the blue box is where he gets all his troops from. Then he heads south into the red box and starts the battle. He passed through Gilead and Manasseh, then he passed through Mizpah of Gilead, and from Mizpah of Gilead he went on to the sons of Ammon, and he fights the battles. Now, it seems like, okay, now we're in good shape. Israel takes him down there. He's empowered. They're going to win this battle. Everything will be great. Well, then Jephthah, the talker, the negotiator, the guy that wins a lot of battles just by talking, because he can talk his way out of anything, he opens his big mouth again in verse 30. And here's the key. Jephthah made a vow to the Lord and said, "If you will indeed give the sons of Ammon into my hand, then it shall be that whatever comes out of the doors of my house to meet me when I return in peace from the sons of Ammon, it shall be the Lord's, and I will offer it up as a burnt offering." All right, so let's talk about vows, first of all. Are vows acceptable? Are vows to God acceptable? Yes, but they're not always advisable. It's okay, because if you go through the Old Testament, you will find a lot of commentary and laws about vows. For example, Deuteronomy 23, verse 21, "When you make a vow to the Lord your God, you shall not delay to pay it, for it would be sin in you, and the Lord your God will surely require it of you. However, if you refrain from vowing, it would not be sin in you." So be careful if you're going to put God's name on something. "You shall be careful to perform what goes out from your lips, just as you have voluntarily vowed to the Lord your God what you have promised." And most of the verses say very similar things. If you put God's name on your vow, you're obligated to do it. Now, we'll talk about, there are some out clauses, but we'll talk about that. Gary Enrich said, "Zeal without biblical understanding becomes a fanaticism that destroys everything it touches." Remember, I kind of touched on it Sunday. A little bit of truth and a whole lot of ignorance is a bad combination. And that's what we have with Jephthah. He knows Yahweh is there. He knows he's powerful. He knows Yahweh can do great things. But his vow is in no way centered on his glory. His vow is centered on Jephthah's own glory. And the vow is really without parallel. We don't see any other situation that mirrors this. This is a very unique story. Judges 11:30 records the first and only time in the entire book in which the man speaks directly to God himself. Jephthah is the first judge to speak to Yahweh himself, and what's the interesting thing? God doesn't answer. God does not respond. There is no confirmation of this. Even Gideon got the confirmation on his fleece when his faith was weak. We don't get that here. In previous verses, Jephthah skillfully negotiated with Gilead and Ammon, and in this instance, he's still negotiating, but this time he's trying to manipulate God, and his diplomacy is not going to go nearly as well as it did with those human institutions that he was dealing with earlier. And with Gilead, he achieved everything he wanted. With the Ammonites, he schooled them with history and logic. With the Lord, he doesn't even receive an answer. Jephthah is so arrogant at this point that he imposes his desire upon God, and he expects a gracious response. There's a whole sermon here to talk about. We don't get to put our expectations on God and expect him to, you know, he's not the divine bellhop that jumps to our attention every time we request something. And so Jephthah is assuming that. If we had to pick out his tragic flaw, if it was a Shakespearean play, this would be it. It's just his arrogance and his lack of understanding of who Yahweh really is and what this means. Another commentator says, "His negotiations with the elders, his diplomacy with the Ammonites, and his vow all have amply displayed Jephthah's facility with words. Jephthah, we know, is good at opening his mouth." How ironical that his name means literally, "he opens." "What has precipitated the crisis with his daughter is that he has opened his mouth to Yahweh. That is, he has tried to conduct his relationship with God in the same way that he has conducted his relationships with men. He has debased religion, a vow or an offering, into politics." That it's all just kind of the same thing. And ironically, although the vow was intended to win security for Jephthah, it becomes a trap for him. This will be the trap that happens. Look at his last statement to the Ammonites in verse 27. "May the Lord, the judge, judge today between the sons of Israel and the sons of Ammon." Well, don't worry, he will. God will judge, and he'll judge justly. You don't need to worry about that. Proverbs 20:25 says, "It is a trap for a man to say rashly, 'It is holy,' and after the vows to make inquiry." You know, don't shoot first and ask questions later. If you're going to bring God's name into this, understand how big a deal that is. Understand how binding that is. And of course, Jesus takes this same idea in Matthew 5:37. "Let your statement be yes, yes, or no, no. Anything beyond these is of evil." Remember, the Pharisees were trying to get vows that they could get out of. They knew, "I can't make a vow to God. I can't swear on God," so they would swear on the temple, or they would swear on Jerusalem, or they would swear on their own head. And Jesus comes in and says, "Hey, God created all those things too. You're just as sinful if you break that vow as if you did this one. So how about you be a man of integrity and let your yes be yes and your no be no?" And so you see, vows can get people into trouble very quickly. Ecclesiastes 5, 4 and 5, when you make a vow to God, do not be late in paying it, for he takes no delight in fools. Pay what you vow. It is better that you should not vow than that you should vow and not pay. Again, same thing we saw in Deuteronomy 23. And on top of all that, this vow is entirely unnecessary. He's winning the battle. It's superfluous. It's just, it doesn't make any sense. He has everything to lose by making this vow. Nothing to gain and everything to lose. Gilead has already said, we're going to make you our leader. You're going to be the head honcho around here. If you win this battle, he has everything to lose. And look at his demands again. Give the sons of Ammon into my hand, and when I return in peace. Not when you defeat the Ammonites, when you save Israel, when you deliver Israel. No, when I win and when you give him into my hand. It just shows you this promise that he's making to God. It raises a lot of questions on Jephthah's faith. Even Gideon said, for the Lord and for Gideon. At least he included God in his cheer. Samson says, avenge me, much like Jephthah does. It's very self-centered. But Judges 11, 32 and 33 says, so Jephthah crossed over to the sons of Ammon to fight against them, and the Lord gave them into his hand. So he says, give them to me, put them in my hand. Scripture says quite clearly, the Lord wins this battle. He, the Lord, struck them with a great slaughter from Aroer to the entrance of Minnit, 20 cities and as far as Abel Karamim. So the sons of Ammon were subdued before the sons of Israel. So if you want to know where the battles were, that's where we are. We're way out here in the desert. We're a long way from mainland Israel, but we're down here and that's where the battles take place. The Lord wins the battle. The Lord strikes them. Verse 34, when Jephthah came to his house at Mizpah, the battle has ended. He said his vow in the midst of it. Behold, his daughter was coming out to meet him with tambourines and with dancing. Now she was his one and only child. Besides her, he had no son or daughter. And now we get to the really difficult part of the story, don't we? She was his one and only child. Besides her, he had no son or daughter. This language should sound somewhat familiar, that this is your one and only daughter. Do you remember what God tells Abraham in Genesis 22, your one and only son? This is really, if you want to spend some time with it this week, look at Genesis 22 and this chapter in Judges. This is kind of the twisted Abraham story. There's so many parallels in the language that's used between the Abraham-Isaac story and this story. In that situation, it's a son. In this situation, it's a daughter. In that situation, God speaks and stops the sacrifice from happening. In this situation, God is silent. He's been silent the whole chapter. In that one, God initiates the sacrifice. In this one, Jephthah initiates the sacrifice. In both cases, the first thing that both of them say to their fathers is, my father. They address them the same way. There's just some really interesting parallels that go on. Of course, we look at the Isaac story and we go all the way up to John 3 and God is his only begotten son. This is your only son, your only daughter. So the irony is, if we were reading this for the first time, we find out that Jephthah has only one child. So in putting her at risk, he also jeopardizes himself, in that as he secures his own victory, he sentences his lineage to death. He will not have grandchildren. He will not have a line because of this. And so this conquering hero, and notice I put hero in quotation marks, Jephthah's nameless daughter is obviously special in his mind. She is the perfect sympathetic foil for her ambitious and conniving father. Just picture it. Here's this guy full of himself. He's made this frivolous vow, and here's his daughter running out to greet him. She loves him. He's her hero, that he's won this battle, and she's coming out to meet him, and he knows what he's said. She doesn't know the results of the battle, but when he sees her, obviously, that changes everything. So we'll come back to the text in a second, but we got to address the elephant in the room, which is, did Jephthah kill his daughter? Now, there are two main views on this. One is that Jephthah sacrifices his daughter as a burnt offering and kills her. The other view is that Jephthah offered his daughter as a perpetual virgin to serve at the temple, and that in that sense, he loses his lineage in that way, that she'll never marry and have children. All right? So those are the two major interpretations. I'll go through some of the points and counterpoints right now so we can talk about that. But if we were going with interpretation one, the fact that he offers up his daughter as a burnt offering, a sacrifice, his reaction to her coming out of the door is pretty strong. We'll talk about what he says in just a minute. But I guess you could say, on the other side, well, he would have been sorry either way because he's losing all that. But I think the desolation that he feels is pretty strong. We'll see in a minute. She receives a two-month reprieve before Jephthah carries out the vow. So that might suggest that she died. Of course, somebody could apply that the other way as well. The institution of a four-day annual feast, which we'll see at the end of this chapter, argues maybe for her death. But then maybe it's just arguing that the feast is to celebrate her wonderful behavior in response to all of that. Until the Middle Ages, every church father believed that it was a physical sacrifice. After that, some new ideas started to come out on how to interpret that. But the antiquity doesn't guarantee that's right, but you don't know. Okay, so number two, Jephthah dedicated her to the service of Yahweh at the tabernacle. So the text does allow for the possibility, but I would argue you have to do a couple jumps to get there. If you're reading it in its most straightforward way, you're going to come down on the sacrifice side of things. I don't like that. When I first started looking at this years and years ago, I went, oh, well, it couldn't be number one. He couldn't have sacrificed her. It's just too much because, you know, he's an Israelite. Israelites don't do human sacrifices. And, you know, and then we see him in Hebrews 11. And how could he have done this? How could anybody have done something like this? The Mosaic law says child sacrifice is an abomination. But, I mean, if we look at the story, Jephthah violates Mosaic law left and right. So do a lot of the other judges. So I don't think it rules it all out. But I think if we know anything about Jephthah, it's that he's influenced by Canaanite practices. He lives in Gilead and then even further out. And if you know anything about the history of the Old Testament, you know that the other side of the Jordan falls away from God even quicker than the ones on this side of the Jordan. They're always viewed as more wicked and more pagan and less Israelite. And so he's living amongst Ammonites and Amorites and Moabites. And if we look at that throughout the scriptures, Judges 10:6 says, then the sons of Israel again did evil in the sight of the Lord, served the Baals and the Ashtaroth, the gods of Aram, the gods of Sidon, the gods of Moab, the gods of the sons of Ammon, and the gods of the Philistines. Thus they forsook the Lord and did not serve him. And the commonality between Chemosh and Molech, who were the gods of Moab and Ammon, both required child sacrifice. And he lives in those neighborhoods. So he's around. His mother was possibly a Canaanite harlot or a cult prostitute from a temple at one of these pagan gods. And so he would have been influenced by that. And then we see Moab again in 2 Kings 3:27. The king of Moab took his oldest son who was to reign in his place and offered him as a burnt offering on the wall. These were wicked, wicked nations that participated in these abominable things. And that's where he lived. So, and they viewed these things as religious things, a noble thing to do. To offer your child would be a noble thing to do to these pagan gods. And so if he was influenced at all by that, and he doesn't know Yahweh very well, he doesn't know the word very well, he could get into trouble pretty easily. Hey, Jephthah made his name as a bandit in the hills of Gilead. It's conceivable that he took much from the Ammonite and Moabite culture that surrounded him. And after his rejection by his family, Jephthah may have had ill feelings toward Israel, even God. You know, these worthless men that surrounded him. Who were these guys? We don't know who they were, but the worthless man literally is sons of Belial. Hey, these were probably pagan men that he hung out with. So for the Moabite or Ammonite, child sacrifice was not rash or impulsive. It was a serious expression of religious devotion. How much was Jephthah influenced by those nations? Was Jephthah so determined to achieve victory over the Ammonites that he was willing to sacrifice his own child to gain a divine guarantee? Because let's be honest, he's got to understand that there's a possibility that his daughter comes out of that house first. I mean, that's got to at least be common sense. I mean, he's just throwing this out there, that the first thing that comes out. A man returns home following a dangerous military campaign. I mean, wouldn't you expect your family to be the first ones out? I mean, maybe if you got a dog, maybe the dog beats him out the door. But wouldn't you expect your family to welcome you home? Oh, you're alive and you've won. I mean, that you would think that. He's got to know that. And then if we think about it even other, what if an unclean animal walked out the door? I mean, what if it was a pig? Well, he can't offer a pig on an altar to Yahweh. That's an unclean animal. So I mean, silly is not the right word. It's so desperate in a situation where he doesn't need to be desperate. He's got to know this can go really poorly. I mean, when you think about the animals that they sacrificed, there's only a few that he could have sacrificed. So was he just hoping that the goat comes out or the sheep comes out? Because most of the things he won't be able to do that with. And so there's a question there. What's he doing? What are we supposed to learn about Jephthah here? So let's get back to the text. When he saw her, he tore his clothes and said, "Alas, my daughter, you have brought me very low, and you are among those who trouble me, for I have given my word to the Lord, and I cannot take it back." So this, the tragic hero, Jephthah, I want you to look at his words there, but he's really a pathetic picture of ignorance, brutality, ambition, and self-centeredness. Ironically, the master of his own fate, you know, the talker, the negotiator, he becomes a victim of his own words. The conquering hero is captive in his own house. The spirit empowerment we saw earlier in the story is gone. We don't know when that spirit left, but the spirit is gone. Certainly not on him here. Did it leave when he made that foolish vow? Did he leave at that point? We don't really know. But look at the response, I think, is very telling. "Alas, my daughter, you have brought me very low." The NET translation says, "Oh no, my daughter, you have completely ruined me." Do you see what he's... Not, "Oh, I'm such an idiot for making that vow." "You have ruined me. Why'd you come out of the house first?" He blames her. "You are among those who trouble me." The NET says, "You have brought me disaster." "You have brought me disaster." You see, he's still selfish in this moment. And he says, "I have given my word to the Lord, and I cannot take it back." Now, is that true? Or does Jephthah have options? Well, I'm going to show you that he does have options, but he's too ignorant to realize that he has options. He doesn't know enough about God. He thinks, you know, does he think God's going to honor this? Does he think, okay, God would want me to kill my own daughter? I don't know, but let me show you this. He has options. Number one, sacrifice his own honor and leave the vow unfulfilled. He can just not do it, and he can take the brunt of the punishment. Right? I made the vow. I'm not going to do it. I won't fulfill it. I know that puts me under a curse. I know that puts me under judgment, but I'm going to do that because I'm not going to take this out on my daughter, an innocent person in this transaction. And he would have brought a curse upon himself, which ironically happens in any case because he's going to lose his daughter in this, but it would have at least spared his daughter and allowed him to have a future. Option two, he could have followed the Torah law. Leviticus 27 says, if you make a vow, you can go to the tabernacle and you can pay shekels to the priest and pay off your vow so that your vow can be annulled. Now, you got to go to, only the priest can do it, but you have to go to the priest and you have to make a monetary offering and he can cancel your vow. Okay? And so again, I think this probably shows you his ignorance of the word of God. Now, the Jewish tradition is really interesting in this because the high priest at the time was Phinehas. Do you remember Phinehas from the guy that saved the camp when he ran the harlot and the other guy through with the spear? That's that same Phinehas. He's an old man now, but he's the priest. And Jewish tradition, not in Scripture, says that Phinehas refused to go to see Jephthah, and Jephthah kind of refused to go to see Phinehas, and Jewish tradition really paints both of those guys kind of negatively in this episode, and it says Phinehas is punished as a result for not going and taking control of this situation. But Jephthah's vow reveals to us an unenlightened concept of God. He didn't know what the law revealed about God. His concept of God bears the marks of a Canaanite influence. His belief that he needed to bargain with and bribe God to get him to bless his people was a Canaanite thing. And he also believed that Yahweh took pleasure in what hurts people, that he's sadistic, and this idea is inaccurate and pagan. That's what pagan gods do. They're the fickle ones. They're the ones that are warring with one another. God just says it and it happens. He's not the same as these other gods. And isn't that what we've talked about this with the pagan nations? A god is a god is a god. You just add another one to the collection. Well, not in Israel. There's one God, and one creator God, one sovereign God. And then option three, which is what he's going to choose, he's going to fulfill the vow to the letter. And the text gives us no indication that he ever contemplates any different option, and so the negotiator is going to fall victim to his own words. And so again, the question is, does he offer her as an offering and kill her, or does he give her over to perpetual virginity? Well, let's look at the text. So she said to him, "My father, you have given your word to the Lord. Do to me as you have said, since the Lord has avenged you of your enemies, the sons of Ammon." Is this a remarkable response or what? You want to talk about faith? The daughter has faith. And what does she take seriously? You made a vow to the Lord, do what you told him you would do. I mean, she's the foil in this. He's the arrogant, selfish kind of thing. And she's going, well, we need to honor God. You know, now where did she learn that? Perhaps that's where the faith is. Perhaps Jephthah taught his daughter the faith but never lived it out himself. Again, we're trying to find that connection to Hebrews 11. How did he get in this list? You know, was that moment of faith enough in the battle? Because everything else we see doesn't work. Once again, the despicable behavior of the hero is contrasted with the submissiveness of his child. She addresses him, my father, the same address Isaac gives Abraham in Genesis 22. And her logic is simple. You made a vow to the Lord. He gave you victory over your enemies. Now you must keep that commandment. And again, it's remarkable because the daughter's speech provides a theological interpretation of the battle. What did Jephthah say? Give them into my hand when I return in peace. What does she say? He won the battle. The Lord won this battle. He gave them into your hands. And Jephthah declared in 11:27, the Lord has indeed rendered judgment. And second, Jephthah's daughter courageously and dutifully charged her father to do to her what he had vowed. She is a great example of faith. We should put Jephthah's daughter in Hebrews 11. She said to her father, let this thing be done for me. Let me alone 2 months that I may go to the mountains and weep because of my virginity, I and my companions. Abraham took Isaac to a mountain. She goes to mountains as well. But here's what we find out, that Jephthah's daughter has a deep sense of respect for her father and his integrity. She's like, I'm not going to let you break your vow. She's laying down her life so that he won't break a vow, as idiotic as he's been. She has a sense of responsibility. She has a deep reverence for the Lord and a deep love for her father. Now, obviously, again, she has an incomplete knowledge too, because they should know there's an out clause in the law. You don't have to do this. God's not going to take joy in this. She has to be left alone for 2 months to weep because of my virginity. And that's one reason why a lot will take that interpretation that, well, she must be weeping that she'll never have children because she's going to go be this perpetual servant in the temple. Well, I mean, whether she does that or whether she dies, she's not going to have any kids. So you have to make a jump to that from burnt offering to serving in the temple. She chooses to spend her last days with her friends rather than her father. Maybe that speaks to something. And in the end, the girl's friends wept with and for her, but Jephthah wept only for himself. There is no kind of goodbye scene with Jephthah and his daughter. It seems she loves him much better than he loves her. So Jephthah's fate, he was expelled from his home because he was the child of an illicit affair. His daughter's sentence will prevent her from having any children at all. Not only would she die, but Jephthah's line will die with her, and to die without children in Israel was considered a terrible fate. And with his vow, Jephthah had tried to secure his present, but through it, he sacrifices his future. See, in contrast, Abraham was willing to sacrifice his present because he trusted God for his future. Remember, I mean, that's the whole Abraham story, is that he says, you're going to sacrifice Isaac, and remember we talked about this weeks ago, and he's going, all right, God promised me in Genesis 17 that Isaac was the son of promise, and now he tells me to go take him up to this mountain and sacrifice him, and God can't lie, so he'll work this out. He'll resurrect him. I trust the Lord in all this, and I'll lay it at his feet. And here is Jephthah. If you'll let me win this battle, if you'll give me this prize now, if you'll let me make much of myself, this will guarantee my future. And in doing that, being so self-centered, he sacrifices both his present and his future. 11:38 says, then he said, go. Well, that's awful loving, isn't it? Go. So he sent her away for 2 months, and she left with her companions and wept on the mountains because of her virginity. And at the end of 2 months, she returned to her father, who did to her according to the vow which he had made. Again, did to her according to the vow which he had made. What was the vow that he made? That he would offer the first thing that came out of the door as a burnt offering. So again, to jump to the perpetual virginity piece, it's not out of the question, but as much as I can't stand it, as much as I don't want to be that to be what the text says, I think we're looking at a sacrifice here. I think that's what Jephthah did. And she had no relations with a man, thus it became a custom in Israel that the daughters of Israel went yearly to commemorate the daughter of Jephthah the Gileadite 4 days in the year. And there's a lot of strange tradition that goes along with that. But there's no memorials to Jephthah, but the memory of his daughter was immortalized in a festival that was celebrated annually in her honor. So she is the one that's put on display here. So there's consolation in the fact that even though we don't know the daughter's name, her companions did, her peers did, and the daughters of Israel preserved her memory in their annual ritual. Now, everything we have on that is mostly outside of Scripture. So again, now we get to the point of how did Jephthah make it into Hebrews 11? That's a great question. I wish I had a great answer. Because here's the interesting thing is you could probably, because sometimes we'll get things that are laid out in extra-biblical tradition. And we talked a little bit, like a Genesis 6 idea with the watchers and the fallen angels and stuff. There's a lot of extra-biblical material on that, and we can kind of fill in maybe some gaps with that. But the Jewish tradition on Jephthah is not positive. The rabbis don't like Jephthah. They all talk about how negative he is. I've got a quote here. It says, when he was on the point of immolating his daughter, so it shows you they're believing he's burning her up, she inquired, is it written in the Torah that human beings should be brought as a burnt offering? So they have the daughter saying, are you sure you should be doing this? Because child sacrifice is a sin. And he replied, my daughter, my vow was whatsoever cometh forth of the doors of my house. She answered, but Jacob too vowed that he would give to Yahweh the tenth part of all that Yahweh gave him. Did he sacrifice any of his sons? But Jephthah remained inflexible. His daughter then declared that she would go herself to the Sanhedrin to consult them about the vow, and for this purpose asked her father for a delay of 2 months. So there, the Jewish tradition is that during those 2 months, she went to the authorities and said, hey, is there any way we can get out of this? Now, you don't see that in the text at all, but that's the Jewish tradition. And the Sanhedrin, however, could not absolve her father from the vow, for God made them forget the law in order that Jephthah should be punished for having put to death 42,000 Ephraimites, which is going to happen in chapter 12. Now, I'm not suggesting that that's what happened, but I'm just showing that to say the rabbis don't have a spin on this. Now, I know the Jewish people wouldn't have no idea that Hebrews is, you know, they don't have any interest in justifying what's written in Hebrews 11:32, but I say it because it's really hard to find anything positive anywhere written about this man until we find him in Hebrews 11:32. Now, what can I take from that? Well, we do have a Holy Spirit that inspires our word. He's there for a reason. And so let me come back to that Gollum illustration that I had from Lord of the Rings earlier. And at the end of the book, Frodo makes this statement. He says, yes, said Frodo, but do you remember Gandalf's words? Even Gollum may have something yet to do. But for him, Sam, I could not have destroyed the ring. The quest would have been in vain, even at the bitter end. So let us forgive him, for the quest is achieved, and now all is over. So this is the best I got, and I'm not entirely satisfied with it. Hey, because it's not compelling. Again, at least with Samson, we have an explicit exclamation of truth before his final breath. We don't have that with Jephthah, but that Jephthah's faith was used in spite of himself, that he knows God, he recognizes who God is, he calls him by his covenant name. When he trusted him, he was empowered with the Spirit, but there's not a lot of meat on the bone there, and God once again accomplishes his will through an imperfect vessel. So will we see Jephthah in heaven? Well, I think we have to say yes, because he's listed here in a list of people who believe by faith. But how did that happen? I mean, talk about getting in by the skin of your teeth. I mean, it's got to be this guy. So again, there's probably not, as we talked about, as ugly as Samson's story is and as dark as Samson's story is, at least there's a glimmer of light there. This is the most difficult story, I think, in the Old Testament, in addition to the last three chapters of Judges and the Levite and the concubine and all that. That's really ugly, too. But we don't really know all their names and everything. We have a judge who is listed in Hebrews 11:32, you know, and so I think it becomes the most difficult one for us to reconcile. We've got a few minutes, so does anybody have any questions or comments? We can kind of talk that out. Yeah, Darla, go ahead. Yeah. Well, the fact that he says burnt offering means, you know, when you did a burnt offering, the entire sacrifice would be burnt up. So this is not, there's no way you could interpret that as, okay, it'd be hard to make that jump to something that didn't involve the death of a living being, or an animal in most cases, obviously. But in this case, that's why I think it points to the literal fulfillment of it. Yeah. Yeah, Lori, go ahead. Yeah, it does defeat the 20 Ammonite cities that were in Israelite territory are destroyed, and their stranglehold on that side of the Jordan is broken. So yes, Israel is delivered by the battle. Yeah. Yeah, because that's the only thing in that list that he accomplished is to defeat those enemies. Yeah. But again, that doesn't give us a lot of happy, warm, fuzzy feelings after all this. Yeah, Tom, do you have something?
You know, I just read Jephthah and I was really confused by the story.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. Yeah. And that's a good point. Yeah. Tom's referencing the talk he has with the Ammonites, he gives a great Old Testament history lesson there in the law and what's going on.
And then he's talking about burnt offerings, so on and so forth.
Yeah. Yeah.
Already that we know about.
Yeah. You know, or did, you know, what did the Lord bring him somebody early in his life that we don't have here that taught him the faith, and but when he got a little bit of fame and a little bit of notoriety, the pride went to his head. But if that's, we're totally speculating on that because we don't have the childhood narrative. We just know he got kicked out of the house at that point. Yeah, unless
we. You don't do that, and over our dead bodies when you do that.
Yeah. Absolutely it is. Yeah, that why doesn't Israel rise up and say, wait, we don't do that here? Well, it's not the only time child sacrifice happens in Israel. King Manasseh does that down in the Hinnom Valley and all that later on. My only thought on that would be, how would he get away with it? Well, he's on the other side of the Jordan. They're a little bit further away, and by winning that battle, he was made leader of the whole place. So he kind of, maybe there's nobody there. If they're sitting around going, what are we going to do? The Ammonites are here. Nobody's here to lead us. We got to find this guy to lead us. There must not be a lot of leadership over there. And because of his position, he can pretty much do whatever he wants. But yeah, and that would speak to the spiritual state of Israel, that there's nobody there to, you know, take that guy out before he lights his daughter on fire. I mean, that's crazy if that's what really happened. Yeah, it's disturbing. And again, Judges is rock bottom for the Old Testament. Understand, it's to show you how quickly it fell and how quickly and depraved it got in that whole thing. And they're calling out for kings. They want to be like the nations. They're worshiping other gods. After Joshua's death, it falls apart so quickly. Yeah, Dave, do you have something? Yeah, that's a good point. And that's a clear violation of the law, that if he's acting somewhat as a king. Now, he's not the king over all Israel. Obviously, they don't all recognize him. But as a king, you know, little k king, and offering an offering, which would be a priestly duty. So, yeah, that's a good point as well. He certainly doesn't take her to the tabernacle to do this. You know, he's probably doing this on an altar somewhere over there, which, again, speaks to the idolatry that's going on in the land. Anything else? We'll talk when we get home, buddy. Anything else? I mean, like I said, this is a difficult thing. Yeah, Connie, go ahead. Yeah. Yeah, and the tradition says she does say that. Now, the text says, do what you got to do. But, if you don't want to dwell on Jephthah, dwell on his daughter a little bit and the faith that she shows and the sense of her reverence for her father, who is certainly an imperfect guy, but she honors her father through this. My goodness. You know, you've done it, that you vowed it. The Lord gave you what you asked for. You have to do this. We have to honor God. I mean, there's some faith going on in that story. Maybe that's, add her to your list of people you want to meet when you get to heaven. Go find Jephthah's daughter and find out what really happened in all this. But it's one of the more unsatisfying studies because normally I like to walk away from something and going, this is what happened, this is what it is, I can nail it down, this is what it says, this is a difficult story. And it does reveal the levels of human depravity. It reveals so much about human nature and the what ignorance can do to a person and what they can convince themselves of as what is right. So Next week we get to cheer up a little bit because I think we get to King David next week. David and Samuel the next 2 weeks. Some positive things. Let's get out of this darkness of the judges and we'll get a little bit happier with David, Samuel, and the prophets. So let me close this in prayer. Father, thank you for today. Thank you for your word, even when it's difficult. And I just, you are sovereign and your word is inspired. And it's good for us to be challenged every now and then. It's good to be stretched in this situation, but again, you show us how dark our hearts can be as fallen human beings and how much we need a Savior, how much the light of the world is so necessary to bring us to salvation, to redemption, to illumination, to understand true right and wrong. And Lord, continue to sanctify us. Continue to mold us into the image of your Son. Bless us and keep us as we go, Lord. Thank you for this time that we've had together, and we glorify your name in Jesus' name. Amen. Thanks, guys.